The CSUMB President's Speaker Series presents Belva Davis.
Good evening. My thanks to President Diane Harrison for inviting me to come here to this wonderful, invigorating campus. I've had a great day. I've been here all afternoon. I met your students. They are absolutely wonderful. We had a great exchange here in this auditorium earlier this evening. And you've just heard from Diane a great deal about me. Writing a memoir is a courageous act, even when you have something to say, because you wonder whether what you have looked upon as valuable in your life will have value to anyone else. So you have to go beyond the storytelling of the incidents and try to get to some of the feelings or whatever the motivation was for you to have done whatever you did with your life. For me, it was made somewhat easy because you're looking at a woman who has never met a piece of paper that her fingers have touched that she wanted to throw away. You can ask that of my husband. He will tell you. But I was also fortunate because, along with other things, I was helpful in saving some of the news film from the early days of the 60s and 70s at what was then the number one television station in the San Francisco Bay Area by far, the leading station, the CBS affiliate Westinghouse station. One day I was just walking near our station in between buildings where we were and saw a group of rental trucks. And they were loading on boxes. And just casually, I asked one of the guys there loading it on, "What are you taking away?" He says, "All this film." "All what film?" "All this film. They need this space." Well, we had a new program manager who had no vested interest in the Bay Area, Bay Area's history, but was looking forward as to how he could leave his own imprint. So he'd ordered that it all be taken to the dump. My colleague Roland Post and I, brave as we were, not even knowing this guy, went back in and, you know, all but said, "What is the matter with you?" Well, we won one part of that argument, but not the other. We never convinced him that the material was valuable, but he said, "If you want to take responsibility for it, I will allow you to, and I will send the trucks away for today," but he gave us a time frame in which we had to get rid of it. Well, we managed to get somebody at Beacon who had no real interest in TV news other than a person smart enough to know when some things are valuable, who offered us free space for a short period of time until we could figure out what to do next. This went on for a time, and finally we approached San Francisco State just to find out if they would keep the boxes, and they did. And today we have the San Francisco TV Film Archives that I ask you to go and visit if you're at all interested in the past history of this area. So an act done without forethought, but just because we didn't think it was the right thing to do, managed to save the history, many historic moments from our area. And it's so much like life itself. We take actions, not often knowing what the impact will be, not often knowing what the outcome will be, but we do what we find in our minds and in our heart, what we think is right. And for us, it was not right to do what was happening at that moment. With all of the years that I have spent in before the camera, on radio, and in newspapers, people still tell me when they read Never in My Wildest Dreams that I didn't know that about you. And that is one of the highest honors they could give me, because my early years were not easy. one could almost say they were stereotypical in many ways. But my background never became the story. And I did not know that for sure until this book came out. And some of my best friends talked to me about it. I believe that having gone through the things that I did as a child growing up gave me the tools that I needed in an industry that was new to so many of us, television news. When I started in TV news in 1966, there was 15 minutes of national news a night and 15 minutes of local news. And when the decision was made to expand the news, they added 15 minutes. That made a 30-minute block. And that required hiring a couple more people. And so two more of us were hired, giving four full-time reporters jobs at the CBS affiliate station in San Francisco. And from there, it was like a rocket taking off. We had some years of slow growth, but nothing but growth. KPIX was a wonderful place to have learned my trade. As to that beginning that I think taught me how to negotiate and how to learn to be as independent as I could by observing, studying, asking questions, and trying to know what it is that was expected of me, that allowed me to operate in a newsroom where there were no women reporters and where there certainly was not a black woman reporter. So what was this rough beginning? I was born to a teenage mom, 15 years old. I was born in the town of Monroe, Louisiana, in the year of what they call the Great Flood. It was a year in which the water in Monroe, Louisiana was at 40 feet above flood level from February to April. It was a wretched time. And if I ever wondered why my mother, at 15, tried to find another place for me, that was the explanation of all explanations. But I was given to her sister, had a wonderful few first years, not quite four before she developed tuberculosis and died. From there, it was an uncharted course of living with one relative after the other, but always some relative would take me in. I never questioned why I was being moved or why I moved, but we did. I had relatives in Louisiana that lived in all sorts of little small towns around there. I even had one aunt who, Essequina, who lived in the back wilds of Mississippi, who lived in a little cabin on stilts, whose best friend was her shotgun, who planted everything practically that she ate, grew it, or killed it, she said. But my parents would often, when they would drop me off, the payment for her was several months' supply of lard, as she said, and flour, and sometimes salt. So she took me in, and they gave her what she needed to get by. Those were very, very interesting years in teaching me survival. It's where, unfortunately, I learned to hate snakes. We moved out to California by the time I was getting ready to go into the third grade. I think I was going into the fourth grade, but I think they put us, because we had these heavy southern accents, into the third grade. We landed in West Oakland after coming out on the train with my dad. And why was my family in California? Well, I had an uncle who was about my height, who was really sort of a troublemaker, who'd had a bad accident, who sued his employer, not him directly, but the son of a white woman that my aunt worked for, who was a new young lawyer, not well-versed in Southern ways, filed a suit on behalf of my uncle and won. He soon had to come to our house to say all the males in our house had to leave town because my uncle was targeted to be tarred and feathered. He wanted no confusion about who my uncle was. So for that reason, all the men should leave, and they did. Why they headed for California, I'm not quite sure, but the stories I've heard from family members is that my dad heard there was going to be work because there was going to be a war, and that's where they were going to carve out a new living. So we were left behind in Arkansas to stay with our grandfather, but we anticipated so much coming to Oakland, California, to West Oakland in particular, a transitional neighborhood where by the time we came out, there wasn't a lot of love for more Southern blacks. They were coming too fast and too soon for many people. So we came to a two-room apartment, if that's what you want to call it, where all of the relatives who'd left Louisiana, by now with us, 11, were living in these two rooms, dirt-lined rooms, sleeping in shifts. My brother and I did what I had been doing all the time, slept on the floor during that time. We had one impression of California that turned out not quite to be true. And when I tell people why I subtitled my book, A Black Woman's Life in Journalism, it's because of the cultural things that had happened to me growing up that piqued my interest in things that some of my colleagues may not have had any interest in at all. So I'll give you a short picture of what Oakland was like when we arrived. My family had fled the tattered and fraying Deep South, the racist remnants of plantation slavery. Strands of bigotry were everywhere, even in the fabric of Oakland. Only 15 years before my arrival, the stately Oakland Auditorium had housed a meeting of nearly 10,000 Ku Klux Klansmen and their women from around the country, cheering the induction of 500 new members into the National Order. A year later, the local citizenry had elected Klansmen to powerful posts. This is Oakland now, including county sheriff. In fact, the Klan's patronage apparatus was so powerful that the zealous Alameda County Sheriff decided to prosecute a case against them. It would be years later before that prosecutor would be named to the U.S. Supreme Court and would participate vigorously in the Supreme Court's decision outlawing racial segregation. His name was Earl Warren. So we have the place where we are escaping from and finding their neighbors and cousins here in California. So that was our introduction to the freedom era, supposedly, of our lives. We lived in the place where we sat until we could get into the housing projects. Another big step. We were so proud to get a place to live of our own that had walls, that had a real kitchen. And I was fortunate enough to move in with my aunt and my uncle, and for the first time, I had a bed. I was the first in my immediate family to graduate from high school, though often I was told that I wasn't going to amount to much. I think it was my inspiration. It was the flint for the fire that was lit in me to do better. I ended up going to high school in Berkeley, and that's where I got my real first lesson in the use of power. I volunteered, or wanted to be, a member of the Berkeley women's basketball team. It was a while before I discovered why that was not a good idea, and it was suggested that I join the bowling team, so I did. And I wanted to be a really good bowler. So I wanted to practice. I got a job. I had a job at the 5 and 10 store. I was saving my money because I wanted to spend weekends really getting my backhand perfected. So the first weekend with my money in hand that I decided to go down to the Berkeley Bowl to do this extra practice so that I would be really good for our next match, I was there for quite a while, waiting on somebody to help me before I discovered, before the man who was managing the desk that day got around to telling me that I could not bowl there. I argued with him as best a teenager could, that I bowl there all the time with the Berkeley team. Why couldn't I bowl there? Of course, I got nowhere. So I didn't really know what to do about that. I had learned by then, because of my early years, complaining sometimes got you the opposite result. So I tried to work out a solution for myself. So what did I do? I took our concrete driveway on Ashby Avenue near King Street, and I drew the dimensions of a lane in a bowling alley. I took vegetable cans from my aunt's kitchen, and they became my pins and my balls. And that's where I was practicing one day when one of my gym teachers drove by. It was a Cal football day, and, you know, traffic was going nowhere. She pulled her car around the corner from where I lived. She came back and asked me, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm practicing my bowling." She said, "Why are you here with cans on a concrete driveway practicing your bowling?" And I then told her my story. And I did it without tears. Very proud of that. And she simply, instead of discussing it with me, simply said to me, as she turned on her heels, "I'll see about that." And I tried to put it aside. And then a few days later, she came over and she said, "You can bowl at the Berkeley Bowl anytime you want." And I started to say, "But the man said I can't bowl there," and all of the other frustrating things that were going through my teen mind then. And she said, "No, you can bowl there. I talked to Mr. Laton, the principal. He has called the manager, and he's informed him that if all Berkeley students could not bowl there at all times, then no Berkeley students would bowl there at all, and threatened to pull all of the Berkeley Bowl activities out." And I learned from that exercise in constraint and sensitivity that one person taking a rational approach can have an enormous amount of power. And I called it my introduction to the power of one, for which, like Superman, I put on my back that I had the power of one, and what I had to do as I grew up was to learn to use it. The Berkeley Bowl now is this wonderful emporium, you know, of a good and fresh and organic food. So it's hard for people to realize that Berkeley was a place that where there would be discrimination. Moving along in my life, there were some pretty tough years. I had an early divorce because there'd been this kindle of hope and possibility of becoming a writer. So I would just write things, you know, those magazine contests where you write something and send it off. Of course, I guess nobody ever read them, but I would send it off. And one day I did make a contact with Jet Magazine, and they needed a stringer, and I became a stringer for a national magazine, never having written anywhere. I was not paid, well, $5 a week I was paid. Eventually, not at first. But I got a valuable exchange for my work. The editor, each week, would get on the phone with me and talk with me about what I had written and what I needed to do to improve it. He said, as long as I never wrote, this was the first of them, if I never wrote again, and a good time was had by all. That was my favorite line. But I went on from there to working for a paper called the Bay Area Independent. Black-owned paper. Editor was white. Former AP reporter. In from Singapore, spent too much time at the bar, couldn't get a job anywhere else. So I learned a lot from Daryl Lewis. I learned how to put a newspaper together. I learned how to write headlines. Remember, I don't know, I might have just skipped right over this, that I am not a college graduate because I was not able to go to college when I graduated from high school. I was admitted, and we got to the point where I needed to pay my tuition, and I could not find anyone in my family who was willing to do that. They were proud of the fact, since I was the first one in our family to graduate from high school, that I'd gone that far. My father thought I should really, a career as a clerk typist was about all I should aim for. But in any case, I thought that I could do better. And so I started taking these odd type jobs. Now, what did that lead to? That led to the fact that I met Malcolm X, I met Muhammad Ali, I met many famous people who had no other outlet in those times except to appeal to the black media. So there's a favorite story I like to tell about Malcolm X, and you may have heard it because I tell it all the time because I enjoy it so much. And it was the reason I want to tell it is because the stories we hear about Malcolm X are usually so filled with tension that his humanity sometimes, you know, does not come out. But he came in one day with a couple of other gentlemen dressed like black Muslims, which they were, and with the bow ties and the white shirts and so forth. And I got a little ring of a bell in the front from Daryl, the editor, who said he needed my help. And I asked why. He said, well, this is Mr. Malcolm X, and he wants to put something in our newspaper. And I said, they have their own newspaper. The gentleman explained that they wanted to be in touch with brothers who don't necessarily read their paper. I stood there then because I didn't know what to do next. And then Malcolm X said that he had this article. It was quite long. He didn't want to pay to run it. He didn't want it edited. He just wanted it in our paper. It's on deadline day. So I turned to my friend and I said, Malcolm X has this article that he wants to run, and he does not want it edited, and he does not want to pay for it. And Daryl said, we don't have quite enough room to run all of it at this time. He said, we don't have enough room to run all of it at this one time. I said, so how can we, I think I asked, wasn't dismissal, but it implied that the conversation was coming to a close. And finally, Malcolm X said, I will edit it myself. And that's when I told Daryl, he will edit it himself. As though Daryl had not heard the conversation that had taken place in between. But it was a wonderful time when we could have those light moments every now and then in a very tense world. So I called myself Malcolm X's interpreter, only in English, though. I could imagine them, when they were out on the sidewalk, having quite a laugh. Some of these moments are worth repeating because I try to make people who've almost become fable in our mind, to try to show their human side. Meeting with Muhammad Ali, and then walking down the streets of Fillmore with my daughter on his shoulder, and him saying to me, why wasn't I home taking care of my children instead of dragging them down the street as I was? So these were all marvelous people that I dealt with. I moved again, this time because I discovered radio, black radio. I was on the air at KSAN before it became a rocker. And that was also a great period of time for me. San Francisco had four newspapers. We had these wonderful newscasts, Herb Campbell and I, where we would go down to the news rack on Market Street, get every the latest edition that we could, clip out an article, staple it to a piece of paper, stack it, and that became our newscast. We read it word for word, but it was a newscast, and he wanted a newscast. And it's the way that I learned to speak for radio. Black radio opened other avenues for me. It's where I've met Martin Luther King and got an opportunity to see him in relaxed moments, not on a stage, but with a friend, with his feet up on a desk, smoking a cigar and having some laughs, the very thing that he often needed when he would find himself exhausted on this trail of canvassing, you know, the South and the country for funds to keep the movement going. There was one moment, though, that where I thought that I was going to lose my job forever. I was going to be kicked out of media forever. And that was one night when I was working late, as always, and I was talking to an associate who was working late, too, across the divide in a room. And I said to her, "Have you heard the latest about little old ugly James Brown? He put all these members of his band out off the truck in the desert and just left them." And I proceeded to say other things about little old ugly James Brown until I heard, because I was looking at my work, my eyes went up and my world dissolved. I knew this was the end. James Brown was the biggest star that we had. We did headline concerts with him. He bought in lots of money. And here, this Nicky new girl, who barely is getting into the business, barely got her show, is going to come and anger, you know, this great talent. And so I apologized. I did everything except kiss his shoe. Verbally, because I was just saying how sorry I was. And I'd heard all these stories about how mean he was, and so I expected the worst, for which I got the best. And that was a gold-toothed, sparkling smile and a comment that allowed us both to smile. He looked at me and said, "Honey, you really don't think I'm ugly, do you?" What would the girl say to say to that? Except, no, Mr. Brown. Not really. No. Well, those were wonderful days. It was also a period where I could look at things from one point of view, and that was from the black point of view. It was during those times when I discovered, or not discovered, but decided to take an action that was much more important than I thought. There was a story about black women being denied entry into the Miss America pageant. The Miss America pageant, chapter 13 of their constitution, said only women of the white race could compete. That's when the Power of One story came back to me. So I decided to join a friend who was putting on a beauty pageant just for black women. It was called the Miss Bronze pageant. So we staged it. More lessons learned. I went to the Junior Chamber of Commerce, who was sponsoring the Miss America pageant in San Francisco in the Bay Area, explained the problem, said we had this. They said at a local level, there's nothing we can do. Then I said, "Help me do a pageant for these girls then." And you know something? They did. They really supported it. And so we put on the Miss Bronze pageant. The Miss Bronze pageant offered a screen test at Warner Brothers. Some of those women carved out careers that were absolutely fabulous. The group, The Fifth Dimension, the women in it, came from that exercise. This was a volunteer movement. So it wasn't Vanetta McGee, a very fine actress, was another one. So it wasn't that they didn't have talent. It was that the system was screwed up. And it wasn't many years after that, because we had members of their own organization who felt that the rule needed to be changed. And I thought quite often of Miss Entz and her Power One story, how working from within can often get you exactly what you want in results if you're willing to work hard at getting there. I sometimes wonder, though, if that's the reason I got into television. I think not. America was changing. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time, is what I told myself for many, many years. I'd probably been a reporter for 25 years before I realized I must be doing something right. It took quite a while for it to get clobbered into my head. But getting in was tough. there was an incident with, I mean, Ronald Reagan sort of plays a part in my life. If you read the book, you'll find out. But but there was a woman working at Channel 5 who loved Ronald Reagan and who told a newspaper reporter that if he ever was elected governor of California, she wanted to work for him. And she did, indeed, make that statement. It was printed. So the day he was elected, the next day after he was elected, I called the station manager or the program director and said I wanted to apply for her job. Well, they couldn't believe that, but that was the way it was. And it took some while, some weeks, 67 interviews of other people first before I was finally selected for that position. So what did I find when I got into television? A pretty difficult time. I remember, I'm not only a woman of color, I am not only a person of color, I am a woman. There were no women general assignment reporters on the street. There were women reporters, but without putting it into writing or anything else, they just were not given the assignments to go out and do tough news. So the decision was, if I wanted to be a general assignment reporter and I wanted to do tough news, they're going to give me tough news. So they gave me UC Berkeley, San Francisco State, 1967, 1968, 1969. It's how I learned to do television. And I do have a clip from that era. Some of you, there are very few people here who would be old enough to remember this, but let me just show you what it was like to be a person coming from black newspapers, black radio, never had a TV class in my life. I had to depend upon my cameraman to interpret the inside language of the medium. But, and coming in where there was a lottery as to how long I'd last. So, if we can, let's roll that video tip of the college protest.
Some called the 1960s a time of revolution. Protesters in the streets and across the campuses. And a popular rap at the time said the revolution would not be televised. But televised it was. And one of those who brought the images of turmoil from the streets to our living rooms was Belva Davis, television reporter.
During the years of, I call, acute protest, you know, there were so many things. Stop the draft, stop the war, give me, black studies, then Third World, Liberation Front, give me all the ethnic group studies. And it was just a very turbulent time. These were just students who were angry about all kinds of things, you know. Tuition, I mean, everything was up in the air. And the feeling was, from at least the left press, that the corporate world could have made a difference in all of this. They could have pressured the government. They could have joined the philosophy of the left instead of arming itself on the right and opposing it.
Until these demonstrations, strikes, raids, and other disruptive acts are ended, I will continue my policy of asking police assistance to maintain the security of this campus.
The reporters and photographers knew they were not immune to violence from the protesters or from the police.
They really disliked the media. They thought that we portrayed them unfairly. But what else can you do if you have a helmeted police officer with a club hitting heads to the degree that you can hear the crack, that blow? It affects you. And the drama of a student throwing a rock is not nearly as visual or as impactful. And for the police officers, that's what they were avoiding. You know, the rock throwing, keeping the concrete, whatever students could throw at them, they did. Mostly, though, it was verbal, but the names that they called were hurtful. So I understood both sides of it.
But like others, Belva stood her ground and got her story.
Once you realize that they closed down the student union, that you can't exit the square, you have no idea what they had in store for you. And the governor had told Ed Meese, his deputy, I want this stopped by any means necessary. You couldn't get out. You were locked into the space. You just had to stay there and take it.
Actually, the law enforcement officers were attacked by the mob, literally overrun, a number of them isolated by squads of mobsters who tromped on them, stomped them.
Only one time did I really feel fearful, and that was the time when Governor Reagan ordered in a military helicopter to bring a particularly viral kind of tear gas in that did burn the skin and the eyes pretty badly.
These officers were afraid they were really being hurt. You can't allow a free zone where everybody can do just what they want. This is the United States of America, and you have to enforce the law, and the police were charged with doing that.
There is something about witnessing unrest at home, Belva concludes, that changes your perspective when you see it elsewhere.
And when we look now at student protest around the world and you're seeing almost the same images, it's hard to think about there being that much anger and that much passion in our own country that we actually had to take those steps to really quiet people.
I like playing that clip because it reminds us that we had a time as turbulent as those we're seeing around the world in many places today. It was pretty tough. My husband, who's television news cameraman, also a first guy, the first black guy to be hired as a TV news cameraman, had his own problems with authority. But we were known as the the his and her gas mask team. We got gas so much that we both had our own individual gas masks. Our kids thought it was great, and they would tell their friends, to ask them, do your friends have, your parents have gas masks? But they were tough times on campus, and everybody, every side, all of the sides, thought they were on the right track. But it was difficult as a reporter to try to maintain some balance between the students' concerns and the university's responsibility to keep peace there. The problems at Berkeley continued to escalate until we got the one dreaded day that you know about, when one person died and 35 people were actually shot with buckshot that day. At least those are the ones we know about. There were probably many other students who were injured that day, but they were afraid to report it because they were afraid that arrests might follow for having been in the place where they were. For me, on the day of the bloody assault, that was, I said, there's one time when I was afraid. Well, I was afraid that day also that Rector was killed, because to walk down Telegraph and see a line of National Guardsmen, fully helmeted, with gas masks on and with rifles pointing in the direction where you're standing, was pretty terrifying. So that was what I was doing for quite a while, until I thought, well, God, by now they must know that at least I can eat the gas. But so I was talking to my assignment editor, about maybe a change. And he said, we were thinking about that, too, or something like that. And I said, okay. He says, what do you think about taking the Black Panther Party? Well, I didn't say what I wanted to be moved to, so that was my next center of reporting. Which was a difficult thing because I was born in the same town where Huey Newton was born. Our fathers knew one another, not close friends, but they knew one another. I had many friends who believed in what the early work of the Panthers that they were doing, the breakfast program, sickle cell anemia, help for children, after school tutoring. Many of the things that they espoused in the early days are programs that have survived and have been incorporated into municipal government programs today. But at one point, one through their own misdirection, and the other through the government's encouragement to, as J. Edgar Hoover said, to get the most dangerous group in America, as he saw it, through that counterintelligence program, they were encouraged to take on each other. So there were lots of shootouts and guns and things like that. How many of you remember when the Panthers invaded our state capital? Well, I got to tell you, it's one of the most phenomenal things that I don't want to get away too much from this, but I do have about 2 minutes of tape of the Panthers actually walking in to the Capitol in Sacramento. And I'll share that with you. And I won't do any more film things, but I just thought this was just wonderful in terms of recording history and the fact that that could have been lost and we would have never known how all this started. So let's look at the Black Panthers.
In the turbulent days of the 1960s, a homegrown group of political revolutionaries sprang up from the streets of Oakland. Brash, strident, militant, they were the Black Panthers.
It's hard when people are at war, and that's what happened in Oakland. And the Panthers were at war with authority, the sheriff's department, the police department, any department of authority, and the FBI at that time had targeted them as a group that was considered to be one of the most dangerous in America.
The Black Panther Party doesn't attack anyone, but will certainly use self-defense in the event that it's necessary.
The Panthers sent a clear message. They would not hesitate to use violence if they found it necessary in their fight for freedom and equality. And in 1967, to reinforce that message, they executed a bold demonstration in the very halls of power with an armed march to the Assembly Chamber in the California State Capitol building.
I have these Black Panthers up here with guns on the second floor.
Belva Davis covered that story for KPIX Channel 5.
We didn't have a camera there that day. We didn't have any idea they were going to show up. We had to play catch up on that story. So they told, I guess, people who they felt would not betray the surprise of it.
You placed me on arrest? Are you placing me on arrest?
The conflict between the Panthers and the police was at times violent. In April 1968, a 90-minute shootout would leave the Panthers' first recruit and party treasurer, 17-year-old Bobby Hutton, dead. Police said he was armed. The Panthers said he had stripped to his underwear to prove he was not, and that officers murdered him.
We were the only station with a photographer there the night of the shooting. And for some reason, the film stopped just at the shooting of Bobby Hutton. And we were told that the camera broke.
Do you believe that?
In my heart? No.
That was a testy moment in our newsroom as to what had happened. We were just told best to forget it and move on, because whatever had happened to the film, we didn't have it. Well, our really calm, wonderful little life continued onward with covering stories that didn't necessarily have to do with violence. I am very happy to have been part of the earliest reporting on breast cancer in women, and to do the first story about the possibility, not just the possibility, but the fact that breast cancer does exist for some men. And in that story profile, a very famous man agreed to be interviewed because he was so concerned about men having this knowledge. Although I did make a promise not to reveal his name for business reasons, because he was the founder of the Gap stores Don Fisher. His wife now, of course, says it's perfectly all right to talk about that. From there was a pretty difficult period for us, and my time is about up here. But just to let you know that as a family, we were put to many tests. There was a Patty Hearst kidnapping, there was the SLA, and there was Angela Davis. All of this happening around the same time. For some reason, we understand why they may not have pulled off what they had planned if they made the assumption I'm about to tell you about. They thought because my name was Belva Davis and her name was Angela Davis that we were sisters. that shows you their exposure there. In any case, the police came to me to say that they had decided, this is a motorcycle gang, had decided to kidnap my daughter. And we this was checked and checked, and nobody could be sure. They didn't know if it was real or not real, but they decided we shouldn't take the chance. We had to actually move, change cities, change schools, change our lives to get police protection for our daughter because we couldn't take a chance. But we were fortunate to find a school where Joe Aliotto's grandchildren there, and Mira Moscone's daughters were there. And my daughter actually knew the Moscone family. From that relationship explains why I first heard about the shootings at City Hall from my daughter. She was working as a student intern in City Hall, had just visited with the mayor, just left his office when the shooting occurred. She called me hysterical. I was home getting ready to go to work. I was anchoring a show at Channel 9. And I came to City Hall, first to make sure she was all right, and then to find out what was going on. And at that point, I was at the point where a mother really hoped she never really be tested. Do I go back now and stay with Geraldine? Or do I go and do what it is that I'm being, that my profession demands? So it was back to work to produce a newscast for that night, because we felt that at a public station we could take the time and do the better job of explaining the circumstances of the evening. So we got together the leading characters, Willie Brown, Diane Feinstein, Mel Wax, and into our studio, and we did a show that won a PBS National Award. Because it was targeted in the right way, and that was in providing comfort to people. Never a dull moment in our life, so we moved from there, and we had no idea of knowing that in terms of a news cycle and a news month, that these two incidents would come together. But there was a man named Jim Jones who led a place called People's Temple. We all know that story because of the number of people who died there, over 800 people. What we didn't know when that story broke was that, well, we knew part of it, that a woman who had been working in our household, taking care of our children, was a member of Jim Jones' security force. We assumed that she died in Guyana, but we don't know that because we found out later that the name that she gave us, as with many of the older black women who were members of People's Temple and who gave their homes to Jim Jones and their income and so forth, that they didn't necessarily use their real names. But we were shocked to find out that Miss Glover was in our house just because Jim Jones was so paranoid. He thought if there were two reporters, broadcasters in the household, we may get some fragments of information that would help him in case the authorities were going to crack down on him. And so her job was to bring home paper from our house, which she did. I was around at the right time again in terms of putting my interests in the welfare of some people who I cared about very much at the onset of the AIDS crisis. Randy Schultz was one of my best friends. It enabled me to have access to do some of the very first stories about AIDS. It enabled me to be the person on the videotape that explained testing for AIDS. My interests remained keen in that area because I've lost now two program producers to AIDS, and have continued as best we could of keeping the need for education alive. As a local reporter, I had an opportunity to travel abroad. One of my most fascinating trips was, of course, two trips to Cuba, meeting the fascinating Mr. Fidel himself, having an exciting time. He, to this degree, that he would never set an appointment with people like us. Well, I shouldn't say that. That's his modus operandi today. Back then, he had not talked to an American reporter for 15 years when I first had an opportunity to talk. I was fortunate to be there because that was supposed to have been Barbara Walters' sole story, and somehow we got there, we got a story, we got two Emmys, and I've always felt good about acing her on that. I'll close with my last story about my last foreign trip, the big one. And that was to Kenya and to Tanzania. We mentioned it, Diane mentioned it in the introduction. We got there because of the will of one woman, a young black physician who had worked at Kaiser, who, hearing about the bombing, hearing about the need for medical supplies, convinced Kaiser and others to donate $250,000 worth of supplies to take to Kenya and to Tanzania. For whatever reason, there was some discussion, or at least the Kenyan version of it was. There were 5,000 people who were injured, 260 who died, 150 who are still blind today. But the argument was that they were injured in a government, Kenyan government building next door to our embassy. Most of the casualties were from that building. The Kenyans had not yet felt that they had been fully compensated for that. So I have taken on, whenever I speak, reminding everyone that those 10 years later, the Kenyans are still seeking what they think is real justice, and because of the fact that they were not at that time, there was no disagreement between any of Al-Qaeda. It was all their way of getting at this country. Okay, so I went over time, but when you have covered and tried to squeeze 43 years into 40 minutes, it gets a little hard. But I thank you for being attentive and listening. It has been a real pleasure to have been invited here to meet the warm community here in Monterey, and to have the privilege of meeting the young students in the journalism department here, who I think are just on a terrific road to become what we will need when they are ready, because what we're doing now is rather thin and frivolous. And so you're training those folks who are in the incubator, and I hope will bring some of the integrity that we've lost back into news reporting. Thank you very, very much.